Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. It's 4:02 p.m. Eastern on the 16th of July. My guest is Toby Johnson. Toby, am I saying your first name correct?
Yeah, everyone calls me Tobe Johnson, but you can call me
Toby.
Yeah, whatever you want.
Either way is fine.
Yeah, you got it.
Are you a filmmaker, right?
I am not a filmmaker. I was a film student at one time. I'm a co-producer of this documentary that we're going to talk about, Flash of Beauty, and then an author and an experiencer of the paranormal and Sasquatch.
Now, is the movie about Sasquatch?
It is a Sasquatch movie. It's, you know, a personal narrative story that takes care of the witnesses that have experienced the Sasquatch. At least part one looks mainly at the phenomena of Bigfoot.
Where are you located?
Right now, I'm calling you from my own podcast studio here in Port Orchard, Washington.
Is most of the show what you're filming in Washington, or do you go to Oregon and other places?
Oh, yeah. So it's we've gone as far as Florida. Currently, the director, who unfortunately isn't with us today, Brett Eichenberger, is filming in Moscow, Idaho. And he'll be coming back to Portland, his home base, and probably taking off again to Utah.
Wow. Mm-hmm. So what's your overview? What's your big picture on Sasquatch? Is it a leftover? Like, you couldn't call it an ape, could you?
Well, you what could. I think it's a little bit of those things.
Yeah.
You know, my origin story of looking into this since the mid-2000s, you know, it started in the forest, but it ended up in some place altogether more unexpected. And that's what I talk about in the documentary, beyond being a co-producer, and I explain in my book, The Al Moon Lab, which talks about the unique experience of being a witness, but also being something I call a Sasquatch contactee or an extended experiencer of Sasquatch interaction. And those claims are by these people that claim they have Bigfoot in their own backyard, is that they have altogether different experiences than, say, someone like Roger Patterson, who, you know, has the most noted film from 67. But there again, it was a one-time affair between him and the subject matter. I started looking into research from a different angle, just based upon my hunger to get closer to the phenomena and be able to marry together some of these consistencies that these witnesses were saying.
I live, you know, a stone's throw from the Dillon State Park in eastern Ohio here. I mean, I can walk right over to the park, and we do. It's probably been 6-7 years ago. Me and my wife were walking our dogs, and we were actually in the park, and it was getting dark. And I heard what sounded like a cross between a siren and a cow bellow. And it was the most powerful vocalization I've ever heard. It scared the hell out of me. My dogs went silent. It was wild. So I assume it was Sasquatch. I don't know.
You never do. I mean, there's ways that you can look into that on a program called Spectrogram, where you can measure the hertz level of a holler or scream or vocalization to see what it matches up against.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the area you're in is so rich with Bigfoot reports. They have the Ohio Bigfoot Conference every year, which is like one of the largest Bigfoot conferences still in the world, as far as I know.
Is it really?
Yeah, in Salt. Is it Salt Fork?
Salt Fork, yeah. It's maybe 30 miles from here, 30 miles from here. Yeah, Salt Fork is really big. But we've got some really dense forest here, some big mature trees, and we got a lake, and it's very beautiful here. Lots of deer. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, it was an amazing experience. Have you ever heard a yell?
I have. I've heard a lot of different sounds that I think came out of the mouth of a Sasquatch and maybe out of some other unique places. But I've been hungry after the Bigfoot phenomena since about 2005. And so I put a lot of time in getting close to where behavior is exhibited, getting close to, I was kind of like an ambulance chaser, where there was an on-site report, be it 5 minutes ago to 5 years ago to longer. I would still go to those hotspot places, and that's how I got involved in this documentary. You know, Brett and Jill are the ones that headed up this film, and it was done during the COVID period, which, you know, for a lot of people, filming wasn't an option back in 2020, especially from like March to December. And so they picked up a passion project, self-funded it, and heard about my story, which really begins in 2018 in the little town of Cottage Grove. And that's where the majority of the sounds that I've heard and recorded and, you know, have been a part of really take place. So once they found out about our story, they headed down and invited me to be a part of their film, just based upon the fact that I'd so immersed myself in this community, going to conferences, making friends with people, hanging out, asking questions, interviewing, you know, anyone and everyone that would have a witness account. Basically, I would sit down and ask them if they'd speak into my recorder or call in. Back, I think it was back in 2008, I started a podcast on a network called TalkShoe. And so I was, you know, up there with, I think there was about 10 of us back in 2008 doing Bigfoot podcast. And I was one of them chasing down interviews.
You said Cottage Grove. What state?
Oh, so, yeah, sure. I assume everybody knows the metropolis that is Cottage Grove. It's in south of me in Oregon. So it's just south of Eugene, Oregon. Go Ducks, about 30 minutes. And I grew up in the Willamette Valley outside of Eugene, in the town of Springfield or Thurston, Oregon. And that's really where things started for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, if you want me to talk about it, I can tell you just in general, around 2007-2006 time frame, my son and I were on a hike above my high school. This was, you know, long after I'd graduated. But my son was about 5 years old and still had a keen eye about him, like his dad, and spotted what looked like a bare naked footprint walking in the icy mud in the mid-February. And it was walking into the blackberry brush, and we put our hiking whistle next to the impression and took a quick photograph. and kind of sat on the photograph for a while, and ended up finding out that we had a friend of the family that had made a movie back in the 70s on the subject matter. And so we talked to this guy and showed him the photograph, and he said, you know, I invested a lot of years of my life looking into this. They're absolutely real, but I don't look into it anymore. So I can't be much of help if you, if you'd like to talk to somebody. I know this river guide. He's not too far from where you live, and maybe he'd be willing to sit down with you and tell you his Bigfoot story. And so that's when I really got hooked, is when I sat down with a witness and I could tell how sincere the witness was sitting with me here in front of the Eugene Fairgrounds, as it was on a bright summer sunny day. And the guy's just looking me dead in the eye and telling me that he's not only had Bigfoot encounters, but that there are lots of Bigfoot encounters that he's had, multiple. And so that really is the problem here with a lot of the Bigfoot world, is that you make these extraordinary claims without extraordinary evidence, and there's this infighting that happens where people say, you know, yes, we all agree here at this Bigfoot conference, A, B, or Z, that Sasquatch exist, or we want them to be existing. Mm-hmm. Yet, you're telling me that you are a witness multiple times, and that just doesn't seem possible for something this rare. Mm-hmm. And so that begins the infighting and the name-calling and, you know, all the abuse that is slung both ways, personal attacks, yeah, and people making these bold claims.
I would, you know, I think that there are some people probably that just make stories, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think that there are some people that have had these ongoing things, you know. I mean, that's just my take on it. So it, I think it's the kind of the same thing with any of these paranormal fields where you get people and, you know, after you talk to them for a little while, you're like, well,
yeah, sure. Right.
So.
Oh, but, yeah. Well, I mean, when I speak at conferences once in a while, I get those looks at me, and yeah, you watch people visibly, you know, they get up and leave because what you're saying sounds too extraordinary, and it's uncomfortable to watch somebody you think telling a lie tell it right to your face. Yeah. And I don't think they can deal with the ramifications of not only Bigfoot existing, but and we mostly get into this in part two of Flash of Beauty, which comes out next year. But, you know, the Al Moon story is so much stranger than this Bigfoot. That's why I say it started in the trees, but it ended someplace altogether much more unexpected. Hmm. And, you know, those kind of areas that I'm talking about, we don't specifically talk about this in Flash of Beauty part one, Bigfoot Revealed. It is a personal narrative story that talks to witnesses that have been profoundly changed by how their sighting happened or what they experienced during their sighting. Because, you know, in short, you're experiencing the impossible. This should not exist. And yet you're looking it dead in the eye. In some mm-hmm. cases, these are law enforcement officers. Some cases, these guys are military, active, inactive. Mm-hmm. And it has, in so many ways, changed what they do, who they associate with, how they react to stress, what they find enjoyable, what they believe, their religion, their marriages, their relationships with their family. It changes everything for a lot of people. And yeah, so this is rarely covered in a Bigfoot documentary. So for that, it's very unique.
I've heard stories. I've interviewed guys. There was a guy, what was his name? Gosh, he was a colonel. He was in the Air Force, and he was really, really into the Bigfoot stuff. His name's right on the tip of my tongue. I don't think he's alive anymore. Donald Ware. Donald Ware. Colonel Donald Ware. He was really big into the UFO extraterrestrial thing, but he was just as much interested in the Bigfoot story. And I don't know if it was one of my conversations with him or with someone else. They were talking about a gigantic Bigfoot that had, I guess, killed a deer, and it looked like he was offering it to the hunter, like he would lift it up and kind of, you know, I don't remember exactly how much distance there was between the hunter and the.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Have you heard stories like that?
I've heard stories like that. That's a pretty incredible story you just related, Mark, but The idea of Sasquatch having a human component to them is something that people describe all the time. That's a big reason why we don't have people taking shots at them, because when they see at close range through their scope, the humanity, they don't describe, first of all, seeing fur. Let's get this out of the way, that Bigfoot doesn't have fur. They never describe seeing
fur. It's hair.
They describe seeing hair. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like you have hair on your head and your chin and your legs, they describe seeing the same type of hair. The thickness matches, and the wear on the sides where the arms are swinging, the inner thighs are shorter. And, of course, you can see it in Patty as well. They start seeing the musculature, and then they see all the attributes of a primate. But at the same time, they see the humanity of the eyes, of the face, of the hooded nose. And those kind of things, you know, are just the initial step to what is being human. If it looks human, it might very well be human. However, what you're talking about, this sociology and the behavior of something that would offer up a kill, is something that the Native Americans have talked about deeply. And it takes a while to get to know First Nations people and get those kind of stories out them. And we talk about that in the documentary, why that is, why it's tougher to talk to First Nations people than, say, you know, your uncle who had an encounter. So, I've definitely heard those stories about trading. The most recent one that I heard from a Native American involved a grandmother here in Washington State who, back, I believe, in the 70s on the reservation, was trading salmon hand to hand.
Really?
With, a Bigfoot, yeah.
Wow. And that was local to your area?
About, I'd say that's about an hour south of me. Now, the area where this happened, where this claim happened, and of course, there's no evidence of it, but there is evidence of Bigfoot on this reservation. And it involves John and Sarah Brown, who aren't in our documentary, but just to make the quick point that, you know, they were funded by the Olympic Project to look for Sasquatch on their behalf, which is you know, self-funded operation where they mainly have out game cameras all throughout the Olympic Peninsula. And they gave one of their nicer thermal imaging cameras to Sarah's husband, John Brown. And so him and his brother knew that they were having activity on the reservation. They're both natives themselves, and ended up seeing on thermal a Sasquatch come up over the mound of grass below the cow pasture. And so this is a pretty well-known thermal short, I believe it's a short video, like less than a second, but mainly it's about three photos of a Sasquatch from the chest up, and you can see all the attributes of a what looks like the Incredible Hulk climbing up over the mound.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that was some confirmation to me, because of the fact that, you know, John and Sarah, I've been out to their property a handful of times and talked to John, and John vacillates a little bit on what Sasquatch is capable of and what they are. But he can also tell you that they're real, because he's had to deal with them on the res. And there's something to the res and Sasquatch. There's they're a lot more comfortable. It's, you know, it's almost like they have a membership card, and they don't mind coming in day or night.
Colonel Donald Ware would actually say that Bigfoot was human. I never was able to get him to really elaborate on that, though.
Well, the DNA points to attributes of human, and especially on the female side. However, when you do the DNA test, and we talk a little bit about this, I believe, in the documentary for a second with ex-police officer Rich Germeau, who helped get the DNA study going for what is known as the Ketchum study, came out about 8 or 9 years ago, I believe. And what they found in that study is that most of the hair samples, which were blind tested and studied, came back with the male side of the human unknown. And so there was this humanness to the female side. However, the progenitor side, I believe it's called, on the male side, is this unknown strand of DNA. And so why is that? What is it about the male side of Sasquatch that is either has been corrupted or has this new data attached to it?
Wow. That's incredible. Those Sasquatch can be like 10 feet tall sometimes? Is that too high?
I don't think so. No, I've heard reports of 12 feet.
Really? And they're just so big. I mean, can you imagine what their testosterone levels must be?
But there is this, they have all this incredible attributes of a superhero, like right out of Marvel Universe. This is the Incredible Hulk, right? And yet there is this very delicate nature to them. When, for example, in the book, I chronicle the idea of them gifting, which is a phenomena that extended experiencers or Sasquatch contactees talk about a lot, where they are given gifts or items or objects or moments that happen unique and special to the individual that happens to them. And the delicate nature of these small objects that are left for these people in very unique and strange places speaks of something that has a very slight hand. I mean, you almost wonder if they could just sit there and take a tiny screwdriver and open an iPhone. It's such a delicate nature. And those are the kind of things that we chronicled in Cottage Groves. And it was to a degree where it was almost every day we would have some strange, unique gift that would arrive. And a lot of these gifts are attached to, like I said, unique moments that are special for the witness. And so we call these gifts, gifts of significance, because in many cases, these gifts have to do with something that you just spoke of. And there's lots of examples of that in the book. But let's just say, Mark goes camping, Mark's sitting at the park bench, and Mark is thirsty, but he forgot his thermos at home. Well, you will go on a hike, and as you're hiking back on the one trail you just took, in the middle of the trail is a used thermos sitting upright with a little bit of moss on top of it. Now, if you look past that and say, okay, somebody dropped a used thermos, that's fine. Well, it's also standing in the middle of the trail upright, and you were thirsty. So those kind of things, a lot of Bigfooters aren't putting together as being gifts. However, the consistency of the witness having gift for gift kind of matching scenarios of things that they need or want or have already is so abundantly clear that it's time that we talk about it, because there seems to be a chess game going on, or a move on our behalf to not win a game, but to dance or to play this game with something that you can't fully see, at least not yet. Because the elusive nature of Bigfoot is that you don't really get to see them. You get to see the residual of them through DNA, footprints, handprints, and then glimpses of them flying away or fleeing away or flashing away. But very rarely, maybe unless you're in some altered state, do you get to see them full on. And so there enters the Native Americans again, right? Because the Native Americans would tell you that most of them, that Sasquatch comes between two worlds. Sasquatch does not just live only in this world. And although we don't talk about this in Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed, we gear up to it and we hint at it through my story being told in part one and eventually in part two, and through other people that have, hinted at them having unique attributes when they're in their company.
So does that story you were telling us imply telepathy on the part of the Bigfoot? Are the Bigfoots able to read our thoughts, like reading a person's thirsty?
Right. Yeah. I believe so. Although that did not happen for me, not that I'm aware of. If it did, I probably played it off as being my own head. Looking at this as long as I have now, you hear that time and time again, that the Bigfoots don't want me here. The Bigfoot said I shouldn't have brought a gun. The Bigfoots wondered if I am okay. You hear that over and over again. So who's actually communicating these messages? You really don't know. Maybe there's a conduit between Sasquatch, a third-party relay switch, and they're delivering a message. However, some pretty strange stuff has happened when I'm out in the field, which makes me believe and think that Sasquatch can pick people out of a crowd and deal with them.
You talked briefly about the Bigfoot leaving our dimension. Is that what you were saying?
Well, you know, the First Nations people will talk about them walking between two worlds, and they take it very seriously to the point where they put them out here in the Pacific Northwest on their totem poles. And they own these stories. The Longhouses do. It's kind of like a copyright. Henry Franzoni talks about that in our documentary. And so to have a Native American speak about Sasquatch takes a lot of time for them to do that. And the reason is because of the ramifications of seeing a Bigfoot and what a Bigfoot actually means to the tribe, to an individual. Some look at it as a harbinger. Some see it as a good luck. Some just see it as a hairy brother of some kind. However, most of them will say that they are a part of the spirit world, mainly, that okay. they're spirit world animals, and they live here in the flesh and blood as well.
So they kind of go between the spirit world and between Earth, back and forth. So
well,
they
we call it the spirit world, but we don't really know what other where they could be going.
Might be an energy band around our planet. Might who knows, right?
Yeah, yeah. For example, for the people that think that this is a Gigantopithecus or missing link, they've taken these kind of reports as well, where a witness will say, It was standing behind the tree, and I blinked. That's all I did was blink my eye, and this thing was gone. Now, that's I don't know anything that can, you know, move from behind a dug fir or an oak with such great speed that it would be gone with a blink. But is it actually gone? And that's what you have to kind of wonder because of some of the video footage that we have in part two, which seems to show a distortion of some kind happening in and around Bigfoot activity. The other thing that we don't really talk about in part one are these strange lights that appear usually before a Bigfoot encounter, which are, for lack of a better word, UFOs. These are orbs. There's no other way to describe them. They are plasma balls about the size of a volleyball, generally speaking, and different colors mean different types of activity. And oftentimes they are in areas that are definitely not places where you have swamp gas or ball lightning. It helps out to have corroborating witnesses say they're not headlamps, although they can look like a headlamp as well or a quick little flash of light. But they seem to be preceded by rock throwing, which of course is a primate behavior, or wood knocking, or grunts, or an actual sighting. And so what is that? And then you have the issue with disappearing footprints, which is it's a sticky wicket for people that lean into ordinary Newtonian science, because when footprints in the snow walk into the middle of a pasture and they're so fresh that you can, you know, you don't see the secondary layer of snow dropping into the prints, and these prints vanish in the middle of the field.
That's what I was going to say. That had to be what happened. And they
You know, one incredible enough, Mark, I've heard people say that, these things are just walking backwards out of their track.
Yeah, that's it. That makes sense, right?
Yeah. So that's the kind of stuff that you have to kind of deal with. And, you know, they could be right. Who am I to
that
say
would
that
be
that's
more
not
paranormal.
Possible?
If right. they could walk completely backwards into their footsteps. That would be pretty paranormal, too. So, yeah, but some contactees talk about being in a ship and seeing Bigfoot in a ship. Have you ever heard those stories?
You know, the best one that I have heard has to do with Linda Moulton Howe, who I had an email correspondence with her back in around 2008. And she's very interested in the subject matter. And that's exactly what she said. She said she'd been waiting to give a lecture at a Bigfoot conference because of the amount of witnesses that say that they see some kind of cryptid on board, and not just a Sasquatch. They describe seeing, you know, dogman type creatures as well. So Yeah, I've heard that before.
What kind of creatures?
Oh, canine, dogman.
Really? Dogman? I've not heard that one. Like a werewolf type thing?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, we don't get into this in the documentary, and I only hint at it in my book, but we have sounds from Cottage Grove that I have never heard a creepier sound than this. It is straight out of, you know, Werewolves of London. It has everything that would match up to a werewolf horror movie. So
it
makes me wonder. And we have some strange photos too that look like something like that. But it is a moaning canine howl. It reminds you of like the transition of a man turning into a werewolf and the agony that you know, marked man is feeling. It is just so unnerving. And there's a lot of Bigfooters that have reported seeing. Yeah, I've heard other people say, well, it's not a dogman or a werewolf. It's a different classification of Sasquatch, kind of like the baboon has a snout and it has more upright ears. And that's what you're seeing. But however, when you see these hawked prints in the same location where it looks like a dog is walking upright, then we've got an issue with that.
Do you think that the establishment is trying to hide these kind of contacts just because there's something else? I mean, these are clues into the true nature of our reality, I think.
Look at the lack of transparency happening with soft disclosure regarding UAPs and UFOs.
Oh, yeah.
Now, all the marginalized witnesses from the F-18 pilots to the admirals to the people in D.C. that have been marginalized for making a report, you know, it's something that has been reported on for eons now. And now, you know, with the goofy X-Files music playing in the background on every cable news network, we're still coming to a point where they're holding back a lot of information. And, you know, for the most part, anything that comes out of the Pentagon is very suspect to me.
Oh, yeah.
And so I would find it very difficult to believe, and the statement was made by ex-policeman Rich Germeau in our documentary, that, A, the phenomena is not rare. And so if it is not rare, they know about them for the fact that they can study them. B, they're not coming to us to look for information. Once in a while, you'll get reports from witnesses saying, I was intimidated by two guys that came in, you know, to my house or knocked on my front door and basically said, you know, something awful would happen to my family or hinted at it if I went forward with the evidence that I had. I've never corroborated a story like that in my life, but I believe them. But then in the documentary, we have somebody in the shadows that is an active part of a team that looks into the phenomena. And so that's something that people have to deal with.
You know, the people, I wouldn't say all the people involved in the UAP story. I would say that my impression, and I don't like to throw people under the bus, but what I have seen, and I haven't seen it all, I'm sure, the people involved in the UAP story are not really UFO researchers. At least I've seen cases where some of these people have no knowledge of the history of UFO contacts. And if you go back to these cases and ask them about what their thoughts are on these other, like the Hudson River Valley case where tens of thousands of people saw these giant UFOs, or in 1952 when the UFOs were flying over the Washington, D.C. I mean, these people, these UAP folks, a lot of them don't even know about these tremendous cases.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I've been just watched some of the debriefings that they gave before Congress a couple of months ago, and you'll understand exactly what you're talking about, Mark. It's shocking how little they know about UFOs and UAPs. However, these generals that act like they don't know anything, oh my gosh, they're good liars.
Are they? Are they? Wow.
Well, they have to be, because, I mean, one of the statements that they made, and this does have to do with the Bigfoot conundrum, because they say they don't look into something that doesn't exist. However, you know, the park rangers, when you pull them aside, they'll tell you they're real McCoy. And they, the reason they don't talk is because of the ridicule factor and their pension and their retirement. However, I've seen government maps from the Forest Service that show where they keep track of sightings in Oregon, from Gold Beach, Oregon, all the way to Astoria. And they range back to the 1940s to the 1960s to current sighting reports. And that we do talk about in the documentary. So yeah, they do keep track privately. Why not disclose it? Why not just say, you know, this is going to affect the timber industry. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, and maybe they're correct, think that the endangered species of the spotted owl in Oregon mainly shut down a lot of lumber industry. I'm from that community, so I remember it very well. And Weyerhaeuser took a big hit. And then they, you know, started to find that spotted owls also roost not on old growth, but they also roost in Walmart signs, Burger King signs. And they're kind of like, you know, creatures of habitat, where habitat presents itself. But getting to the Bigfoot point, if it did bankrupt the lumber industry, I don't think that's the end of the lumber industry itself. I think it would just change and modify itself into some other renewable resource. I think there's something else going on here with the Bigfoot problem, and I think it's connected to the UFO issue.
So I find it real interesting what you're saying here. It seems like, just like the UFO situation implies that we don't really understand the true nature of reality, it's the same thing with the Bigfoot case.
Right.
So the establishment, generally speaking, part of it anyway, is trying to keep information from the public.
Yeah, because, I mean, if they have that information, they can nurse it to an unwitting public as they need it. Never let a problem go to waste. Well, Bigfoot is a big problem for them. But if they can't use it to, you know, pump up an issue or use it as propaganda to scare you out of the woods. Or,
exactly.
You know, that's what they're doing with UFOs right now, is that they're hovering over our nuke facilities. They're hovering over our aircraft fleets. And they are these UAPs now. They're not UFOs, and that they are anything that can do that, that can jam radar, is a threat. And so these are threat assessments from something.
Yeah. They try to make it a national security threat. I think it's all building towards this, you know, UFO alien invasion.
Now, saying that, I could be totally wrong. And maybe, you know, the Pentagon, for once in its life, is actually telling the truth about something. So I can actually, I can say that that's a possibility. And the same, you know, but however, if you look at the behavior of the witnesses with not only UFOs, but with Sasquatch, most people see a Sasquatch getting out of the area as quick as possible, and they never see it again. That's most of the stories, including the Patterson-Gimlin footage. However, if they have ongoing activity, they describe it as being a trickster type element and a teenage boy behavior, let's say, and that it comes around and kind of slaps on the house and, you know, screams and hollers and just plays shenanigans on the homeowners. And so those kind of things, this does not sound like a big threat assessment to me.
Right. You know, it's also interesting. Some of these Bigfoot seem to move in incredible ways along these mountain ridges and things.
Right.
You know, they can like almost run in places where we couldn't even hardly walk.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. There's something unique about the way they ambulate when they're doing their physical stuff.
And they can move pretty quick.
They can move very quick. Yeah. In fact, you know, one of the stories that I talked about in my book has to do with another ex-police officer by the name of Officer Jeff Boiler from South Sister Bend, Oregon area. And his story has been retold, I believe, on season one of Paranormal Witness. It's called Watched in the Woods. But the real story, it has to do with Jeff going to the South Sister on some time off from the police station, headed from Oregon to California. And he was going to visit the ashes of a friend of his that were interned over a mountainside. And the last time he was there, I think, was a couple years prior. And so he's going to do a solo hike. He shoots an azimuth off his compass, has a rough estimate of where he's headed. I think he's just going to do a day hike and go back to his car, if I remember correctly. As he's coming to an opening area, he sees on the ridge what he assumes is a red, rusted out elk standing on the bluff, just given the hair and the size of it. This thing turns around, looks at him, and Jeff describes seeing a caveman. Him and his caveman have the staring contest, and Jeff drops his jaw to the desert floor, and this thing drops its jaw to the desert floor. Jeff then turns his head to the side and cocks his head in disbelief at what he's seeing. This thing cocks its head in disbelief at what it's seeing. Now, Jeff says, you know, very little about this in the retelling on the Sci-Fi Channel, but what he told me in private, he goes, you know, before I was profiling people as a cop, I was in the military as well. And so reading body language can save your life. He goes, what made me so nervous about seeing this thing is the fact that it wasn't mimicking me. It was making fun of me. It was letting me know that I've been following you all along, you dummy. Yeah, duh. And he goes, that's when I thought about grabbing my gun. And so at the thought, and this is Jeff's word, he goes, it was at the thought of me grabbing my gun that this thing left. He goes, I didn't even reach for it. As soon as my, you know, cop mind switched into gear and my thought about grabbing my sidearm, this thing took off. Didn't have to reach for it. So again, there's a possibility of intuition on a different level. Mm-hmm. And the rate of speed in which this thing left, he said, was unbelievable.
Really?
Yeah.
And was it in the desert?
It was, yeah. It was, the Three Sisters Wilderness is a lot of lodgepole pine. It's a lot of trees out in that desert. It's a high desert forest.
And where is this, Arizona?
No, it's in Bend, Oregon, south of Bend, Oregon, in the Cascade Range and the Three Sisters Wilderness.
Hmm. Yeah. So that's a little harsher environment.
Yeah, it's all volcanic. So you're going to run into a lot of volcanic rock. You're going to run into a lot of, you know, what I would call thinned out pine trees, a lot of scrub brush. So, yeah, and a lot of tunnels, a lot of caves, a lot of places for things to retreat. And, you know, if this thing retreated, maybe it retreated to an opportunity like a lava tunnel, which there are thousands of.
Wow. Don't they have sightings like of some giants in Kandahar or some places over, you know, in that area of the world? Are there any relationship to Bigfoot there, or what are we talking about?
Sure. So how far do we want to reach back with this story? The Native Americans talk about the red-headed giants.
Okay.
Near northern Nevada and California is a place called Lovelock Cave, where the natives, I believe it was the Paiute First Nations people, were warring with the redheaded giants. And it got so bad that the Paiutes were sick and tired of the redheaded giants cannibalizing on them. They decided to go up to the cave and burn them out.
I've heard this story. Yeah.
Yeah. So researcher Ron Moorhead, who's responsible for the Sierra Sounds, and a couple other researchers went back up into that spot to kind of verify the history of this urban legend or this oral story. I believe it's more of an oral tradition story than an urban legend, because their oral stories are facts. And so he went to, I believe he has some photographs of this too, where you can actually see what looked like burned large handprints on the side of the cave wall reaching out from the inner depths. Now, what's interesting about that is that after these photographs went public, and you can still see them, the handprints were chipped off. And so who would have went through the effort to go up to Lovelock Cave and chip off these giant handprints? But then you go to the caves of Kandahar, where supposedly there was an elite squadron of our military that went head to head with what they described as being almost looking like a Roman soldier of kind, a large red-headed Kandahar giant that speared one of the elite team and I think killed a couple more. And this thing was moving extraordinarily fast. It was, I believe, well over 15 feet or something crazy like that. Jeez. But it had regalia on, you know, it had a uniform for combat on, and I believe it came out of the cave itself. So that's never been confirmed. However, I will say this, that I was approached by someone who is interested in the Bigfoot phenomenon. I never met the guy before. He came up to me at the Oregon UFO festival in McMinnville with his family, and he was looking at my stuff and explained his security background, and he's a police officer in Seattle and does private contracting and security work still. And we had a sit down coffee meeting a couple months ago, and I brought up the Kandahar story and mm-hmm. made him very, very uncomfortable talking about it.
Wow.
And I you just kind of have to wonder, because he certainly knew something about it, but I caught him off guard by bringing that up. So those kind of little moments are always fun to have.
Now, he was a military person, right?
He still does private contracting stuff, yeah.
Yeah, he's probably not allowed to tell you some things.
He told me quite a bit, but I think he's a lot more interested in the UFO aspect and how and if this could be linked because of the stuff that's happened to him as well. As when he was on duty, he had a UFO experience in Washington State. I believe it was in the middle 90s, and it was so profound that he dropped out of that part of the service and that detail. So he definitely had some strange stuff happen, but also he had a UFO or a Sasquatch encounter up in Washington State in a very well-known paranormal hotspot. The peninsula itself, where I live, the Olympic Peninsula, is just a unique part of America because it is so vast, it is so old, and it's so unsettled. I mean, we don't really have any major cities over here. You know, you have to take the Hood Canal or the Tacoma Narrows Bridge or a ferry from Seattle to get out to the Olympics. And when you come out here, you have to get a discovery pass in order to go to the parks. And if you're going to go on the reservation, you have to get a reservation pass. And sometimes things are just plain closed down because of how crazy the weather is here, the trees that are falling down everywhere. So it's a very unique area to research in, and super vast. And I, you know, mainly I'm from the little town of Cottage Grove, Eugene, Springfield, Oregon area, which is nothing compared to the vastness of this.
Hmm. I've heard those giants have a tremendous mental energy associated with them. Very powerful thoughts. Like when you get near these giants, you can literally feel their thoughts, their aggression. Have you heard stories like that?
I've heard stories like that, and it makes me wonder about megalithic structures. Because if you look at some of the megalithic sites that have been hidden from us, including here in the Pacific Northwest, there's also stories of the giants in those areas, in particular, red-headed giants. Here we go again with the red-headed giants. The red-headed elongated skull people of Paracas have a huge sagittal crest, and they have weird anatomical structures on their skull that do not match up with, well, they're, first of all, they're not really human. They have elements of humanity with them, but the DNA study done by Brian Forrester points out again that they have unique attributes that have not been studied yet or put inside the gen bank. So I'm looking at a sculpture right now done by one of the gals in our documentary, Marcia K. Moore, who, what Marcia does is that she works with either reproduction skulls, mainly 3D renderings of strange skulls, including the elongated skulls from Peru. And then she puts modeling clay over them to reconstruct anatomically, almost like a forensic artist, but she's not, what these people actually look like. And they have very human faces, but when it gets to the size of the eye sockets, when it gets to just how big their brains are, because we're not talking about something that is cradle-boarded here. The people that cradle-boarded their heads don't have an increase in mass. You can do that by holding a human skull next to an elongated Paracas skull, and you can pour rice inside the skull to see how much volume is within the skull itself, or any liquid form or something like that, although rice is what they generally use to measure volume. And the volume increases substantially, almost like 15 to 20% more inside the elongated skulls. If you're cradle boarded, it doesn't increase at all, because all you're doing is misshaping a skull to look like something that you recognize. So why did the mainly women do this? Why did they elongate their skulls to look like possible royalty? Well, I think it's because of the fact that there was a great reverence. I'm not quite sure why the women were allowed to do it more so than the men's, because they're finding that these elongated skulls are the legitimate ones, are also men and women, but they're in areas that have these megalithic structures that are just so jaw-droppingly stunning, and they scream of an ancient technology that was used, a lost art form perhaps, that we can no longer do or duplicate. And you can see it present, because if you watch Brian Forrester's videos on YouTube, you can see how the Incas basically go up with Legos and stack their, you know, their attempt at building a wall on top of an actual megalithic structure. So when you have the increased brain size next to these megalithic structures, you have to kind of wonder. Now, what's interesting is that these megalithic structures don't just end in Peru. They're all over the world, including North America. The mounds, especially the mound builders of old, we don't really know who they were, but yet the mounds are present. I believe there's an Ohio mound, actually. And that might be the Serpent Mound, I believe, that is over there. We have mounds over here. Mm-hmm. And these are all Bigfoot hotspots as well. And so the red hair is also something that is a Bigfoot attribute. They don't just come in black. You know, Yeti's certainly not black. We have a lot of reports of them being white, not like elderly white, but, you know, really? blonde or white hair. Wow. We also have them as Irish setter or orangutan red. There's some footage of that in the documentary. But my girlfriend, who's also a witness, reports seeing, and we've had confirmation over the last year, that in the area where she saw her Sasquatch, it was green.
Really?
She said it was actually covered in moss. She goes, it had a long mane as it jumped over the skid road in broad daylight in a single bound into the Devil's Club. The mane flowed in the wind as it jumped down in there, and that mane was just covered in moss and algae and brush. So is this part of their diet? Is their hair changing color based upon, you know, the chlorophyll of the plant life? Do they use it as cover? Are they making a ghillie suit of sort? But I'm hearing people say here, First Nations people, this like, no, these are moss squatch. These are these are moss type Sasquatch.
How weird. I've never heard that.
Yeah. Right.
Now, where was this?
So this is on the western northern slope on the Straits of Juan de Fuca. So if you look over the Straits of Juan de Fuca from Washington, you can see Victoria, Canada.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is something that's occurring like near the ocean?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, this is right on the borderline of the Pacific Ocean on the shipping canal. Mainly that's what it's used for. It's also used as F-18 flight zones, because it's a common area for our military. But yeah, it's the Straits of Juan de Fuca all the way to the northern tip of what is called Nia Bay. Is incredibly rich with sightings of not only green type Sasquatch, but also cloaking Sasquatch, which is something that, like, again, we don't really get into it in the first part of Flash of Beauty, but it's certainly a part of part two.
Toba, I just want to let you know, we've got a second hour. You don't have to stay for 2 hours if you're feeling tired or whatever. I totally understand. But we'll probably have a break in about 5 minutes just to, you know, I don't want to cut you off or whatever. This has been this is such a fantastic conversation. And I want to get back to Egypt again. Do some of these leaders in Egypt in the past, say thousands of years ago, have the elongated skulls like Nefertiti or whatever?
Well, you know, you have to wonder based upon the headdress, right? And certainly if you look at some of the hieroglyphics, you see that sagittal crest that looks very reminiscent of what you see in Peru. So it's almost like a serpentine or a serpent's head as it slopes back. And they're also not demure. They are large hieroglyphs of some of these pharaohs or kings that existed back then. And then you see the little tiny Egyptians that come up to their ankles. So yeah, it's pretty curious, don't you think?
Sure. And what about the priests in the Vatican where they wear these tall hats? Is there any relation there?
I know. That's a whole different band conversation.
So are the Jesuits somehow connected to the red-haired giants or whatever?
There's even a Rothschild. I don't know if he's still with us, but there was
Red Shield.
One of the Rothschild has a very elongated skull.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very obviously misshapen skull. And, you know, if you don't have hair on top of these elongated skulls, there's no way you can hide it except through headdress.
Yeah.
Also, the actor from The Hills Have Eyes, who's kind of a character actor, has a very interesting skull. And I've talked to Marcy about that as well. So I think there's some latent issues going on with some of these people.
You know, I don't have a sense that Bigfoot is evil, but I have not yet made my observation of the red-haired giants. So why don't you hang around and we'll finish at least some of the conversation in about 5 minutes. We'll be right back, folks.
After a long day of research and trying to wake people up to what's going on in our world, I need to take a break and find my center. I do this by listening to music or watching a great movie. If you find yourself doing the same, then come chill out with me every Saturday night from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Studio B, Crypt Rick's The Decompression Hour. It's time to put down that research and crank your stereo.
Hey everyone, it's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Did you ever feel that things were not quite right? That everything was just ever so slightly askew?
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
Hey, Madeline.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Join me at Revolution Radio, Studio B, at 11 a.m. on Saturday for Free Association, when we take a look at philosophy, spirituality, psychology, social issues, and geopolitics. It's every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern. On Studio B at freedomslips.com.
I want to thank everybody for listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com, the one place where information never sleeps. Revolution, Revolution Radio!
Show them what we got now.
Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second hour of Ohio Exopolitics. I'm Mark Snyder. I'm your host. I've also got my co-host on now, Madeline Rudy. And we've been speaking with Tobe Johnson. I've been absolutely fascinated the whole first hour. Madeline, did you get a chance to hear any of that, or are you coming in here cold?
No, I'm coming in cold.
I didn't even know if you really wanted to come on or not. I couldn't read your message. I saw you had sent a message.
Yeah, I was sitting here waiting.
You're waiting the whole first hour. Sorry about that. Tobe, do you want to be called Tobe or Toby? It's Tobe, right?
Yeah, I just go by Tobe.
Tobe, yeah. Fascinating. We're talking about the red-haired giants. We're talking about Bigfoot. We're trying to stay on Bigfoot, but there's so many kind of related things like the people with elongated skulls. And we're trying to figure out what the government is trying to do, why they're hiding so much. And, you know, maybe a lot of the government doesn't know. Maybe it's just, you know, Dr. Stephen Greer has always talks about how he believes a lot of the knowledge of these paranormal areas has actually gone into large corporations. I don't know, maybe BlackRock or Vanguard or probably some of the other ones I can't recall right now. Have you heard that, Tobe?
Oh, yeah. I mean, as far as what the overall proof of it is, I've definitely never gathered that evidence. But, you know, there's some interesting stuff happening with all those companies, I think, privately. And you get into CERN and everything else, but
CERN, yeah. Yes. CERN's weird. Like, what are they trying to do with that? Really?
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Open up the gates of hell? Is that what they're doing? I wonder. So, how soon are we going to see your movie on TV or on YouTube? Or where's it going to be?
Yeah, it's been out for about 2 months now.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's called Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed. It was the number 2 doc streaming as far as 7 days back. I don't know if that's still the case, but it's doing really well. A lot of good reviews. You know, not very controversial as far as content is concerned, because, again, it's like the personal narrative story of the witness talking to the camera and telling their story. But it's such an incredibly beautifully shot movie through the most of the hard work through Mike Ferry, who's the primary cinematographer. And so it's quite a beautiful thing to rewatch because you miss so much. I met a lot of people that have watched it 2 or 3 times because there's such beauty in this documentary, and you kind of want to see it again. So that's been my experience. But as a co-producer, I mostly just put pieces together as far as interviews with witnesses are concerned. Wasn't behind the editing of it, wasn't behind certainly the financing of it at all. And again, this, you know, these kind of projects are passion projects. This one, as I said, was started during the pandemic. So it's certainly a passion project for that reason, because of the fact of, you know, there wasn't really much going on during the heat wave of the pandemic in 2000, and that's when this kicked off. So what started off as a six-month project turned into a two-year project with a multi-chapter to it. And part two, the paranormal Bigfoot, will come out, I believe, spring of 2022.
Now, can we see this if we search for this on YouTube? Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed?
Yeah. Anywhere that streaming services are. The trailer is where people usually start on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And the trailer leads them in, pulls them down the rabbit hole.
Wow. Now, this was a real personal thing with you. So you've had visual sightings of Bigfoot up close, or...
Well, most of what I've had is interaction with what can only be described as Sasquatch. And that's based upon the weighty evidence of the latent fingerprints, the knee impressions, the handprints, the hair, the vocalizations, and, of course, the sightings. The property owner, Daryl Adams, and his wife, Cindy Adams, own the property as I researched it and lived there. Daryl mm-hmm. would be a witness on two occasions and would get some okay photographs, but then again, pretty blurry. Mm-hmm. I myself ended up seeing something at 4 a.m, which I can only describe as a light-colored hairy foot standing behind my Jeep and then running through the gravel, screaming like a dinosaur. So although I didn't really get to see all that happen, I got to see this foot do a 180-degree behind my Jeep and duck and run for cover.
And where was this at?
So the mainstay of my book, The Al Moon Lab, takes place, although it does have my origin story, which is also in Oregon. But the Al Moon story is in Cottage Grove, Oregon, in the Umpqua Wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Madeline, you haven't interviewed him yet, right?
No.
You have to get him on your show.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And it's an interesting book for the fact that it's also an interactive book. You know, it's only about 180 pages or so, mm-hmm. but it has over 2 hours worth of audio and video embedded in it on QR codes. And so as you read the chapter, you just scan your phone on camera mode and it will take you to the actual audio and video we shot on scene or describing in detail through the publisher at Hangar One Publishing, which is, you know, headed up by Doug Hychek of the hit TV show Monster Quest. So it's good company to have. It was all Doug's idea and his kids to put these QR codes in there. And I think there's about 40 QR codes.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this technology you're talking about.
You know what a QR code is. It's like a barcode. And sure, so you just put your phone on camera mode and it reads the QR code as a hyperlink.
Oh,
and
really?
It just basically transcribes the black and white box as a hyperlink, and it sends you to, in this case, a YouTube channel.
Oh, wow. Hmm.
Yeah.
Now, where's this place? Is this, I've been to Grants Pass in Oregon. Is it close to there?
Not too far. I mean, it's about 2.5 hours north of Grants Pass, which is closer to the California border.
Yeah,
Cottage Grove is kind of stick your finger on the western portion middle of Oregon, and there you'll find it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that maybe it's close to those redwoods that are there, you know, right off the border of Oregon into California.
Yeah, not a lot of redwoods, but what it is close to is a lot of quartz and gold, a lot of flowing electricity through the Bonneville power line. It's close to a lot of food and cover. It's close to a lot of access to farmlands, including where there'd be people that, you know, a lot of these people that are extended experiencers or Sasquatch contactees are marginalized because, in my friend Tom Pell always says, it's easier to marginalize someone who's already been marginalized based upon what kind of person they are. And that's the redneck, right? The farmer, the middle America guy. And those kind of people are the people that are generally these extended experiencers, the country bumpkin, which I am one. And so these country bumpkins getting these extended experiences are never going to be believed if they go to the media or anything like that. So that's one of the things that, you know, we kind of kid around was like, you know, does Sasquatch know that they're already an unbelievable witness and that's why they're going to them?
Well, I know Mary Joyce, she says she got reports that some of them were really kind.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I think
definitely.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And examples of that would be exhibited throughout these Sasquatch contactees that I've talked about that have said that they brought them unique gifts, including, you know, I was making the example earlier of Mark, you know, getting gifted a thermos while he was out. I was making up a scenario here so he could understand, but the scenario was Mark was out camping and he was thirsty and he goes on a hike to, you know, maybe forget about his thirst. And on the way back to this campsite, he finds a thermos sitting in the middle of the trail. Well, that happens to be a real story. From one of the witnesses, Daryl Adams, whose dog actually was thirsty while they were hiking. And as they were coming back, the little dog Izzy and him were on the same single trail that they just walked. And it wasn't a very long trail. He's going back to his truck, and sitting in the middle of the trail was this red thermos, you know, the kind that you see at Goodwill or any secondhand store, the little plastic ones with a patina of green moss sticking on the top portion. Now, what's interesting about that is that perhaps that met a need for the dog, a container where he could grab water as a receptacle. Perhaps it's unrelated. Perhaps it's just a coincidence. However, when you go back through the stories of the people that have had these encounters in hotspot areas where Sasquatch seem to come visit these camping sites or, you know, these remote areas where people go to often and have Bigfoot activity, these stories seem to all match up, including, I don't know, you guys ever watch Finding Bigfoot?
Oh, no. I'll have to check that out.
It's kind of like a kid's show that was on Animal Planet where these four researchers go look for Bigfoot. And one of these guys, his name's Bobo, and he's like a, you know, a well-known, likable guy from California, and he's also a Bigfoot enthusiast. Well, Bobo has a dog named Monkey, and him and Monkey go out to the High Cascades to an area where the Bigfoot Research Organization reported activity. And so he puts his tent down, brings another cameraman with him, and that Monkey starts to alert that there's Bigfoot by. Now, Monkey's a dog, not an actual monkey. Mm-hmm. And so Bobo uses Monkey kind of as his bird dog, a Squatch dog. Mm-hmm. And so they decide, well, this is the perfect spot to stay. And one of the rituals that Bobo has as he's bedding down for the night is that he'll take the abalone shell necklace off of his neck, which is a profile shot of a Bigfoot walking, and he'll set it on his hiking boot and close the zipper and see if something comes and takes it. Well, the cameraman also went to bed that night and put his hiking boots outside the tent. And as the cameraman woke up, he noticed on his boot was a leather necklace. Now, it was a different necklace than Bobo had left on his boot. That necklace had not moved. However, it is pretty interesting that in the middle of the Three Sisters Wilderness, yet again, there is this gifting scenario taking place where nobody could have came in and snuck a necklace on top of Tyler's boot. So it smacks of something paying attention to what you're giving them. And you hear that time and time again. I left a walking stick outside of my house, and sitting next to it was a brand new walking stick. You know, I was looking for A, B, or C, and the next day I go out to my front yard and sitting in my boat is exactly what I was looking for, only it looks like it was found in, you know, it's a totally different object, but it matches these wants and needs that I have. So there is this humanity to the phenomena. And is it always Bigfoot? I don't know. I don't think this is always Sasquatch leaving these things. I think there's these other unique critters out there that are kind of like the Star Wars bar, right? In Mos Eisley. Mm-hmm. You're not quite sure who's going to saddle up next to you. It may be Chewbacca. It may be Han Solo. And I think once in a while we blame or give credit to Bigfoot when it's something else.
You know, if you think about it, Chewbacca kind of looks like a Bigfoot.
A lot. Although George Lucas will swear it's based on his dog. But it certainly looks like a Bigfoot to me.
Wow. You know, and you talked earlier about the dog people.
Dog men, yeah.
Dog men. Are there dog women?
There is. In fact, I don't usually talk about it too often, but I one of the stranger and more credible witness testimonies that I've ever taken came from a young woman who had an ongoing encounter with a female dog person or dog creature. And we sat down with her for a period of I think it took us 3 hours and a couple weeks to do what we wanted to do. And what we wanted to do is, since I appreciated her story so much and the detail and the emotion behind her story as a child dealing with this creature she called Blondie. Wow. And I sat down with a 3D sculptor, and we hired a 3D sculptor actually to sit down with me and the witness. And we sculpted a 3D model of Blondie for this witness. Hmm. And actually printed it up and mailed it to her afterwards. And, you know, I still have that model myself. It's one of my favorite podcasts that I've ever done. And, it happens to be about what can only be described as a werewolf, a young female looking werewolf, including breasts, just like the Patterson-Gimlin subject, canine ears, canine feet, upright. Very interesting.
What about, and this is way off topic, forgive me, I seem to have a skill for doing this. What about flying humanoids in Mexico? Is any of this related? Have you seen
only
them?
Mexico? That's one way to get over the border. Just get one of those flying humanoids.
They seem to be in Mexico mostly.
I don't know too much about that. I've seen footage of what looks like a guy sitting in a tin can.
Yeah.
I don't know what to think about that, except to think Elon Musk maybe has a summer house or something like that. And
that's so weird.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that Bigfoot's benevolent, mostly. I don't know what to think about. I'm still on the fence here with the giants, It's kind of weird. It's kind of weird, where do you have an overall impression? I mean, I assume Bigfoot is very benevolent from your perspective, correct?
Well, there's a loud noise there.
What is that?
I don't know.
You know, we haven't had any interference yet. You notice?
It's rain.
Are you having rain, Madeline?
We're having rain.
Okay.
Oh, there we go. The flood's right. Coming.
Well, we had a ton of rain today, too. I mean, a ton of rain. So you're probably getting the rain we have.
Right.
Yeah. She's in Pennsylvania, and I'm in
Been one of the rainiest years in the Pacific Northwest. It's like a running joke out here. We haven't had summer yet. It's crazy. It's cloudy right now, I think.
I think we're in the middle of a war that's undeclared. I think the U.S. is under attack. Now, there are some side effects to this attack that are actually good. Like, my garden's growing like crazy, but...
Oh, yeah. Well, at least somebody's it. But I don't remember your question now that Noah's flood came. What was the question?
Oh, we were talking. I'm trying to sort this out. You know, Bigfoot, I would think it would be mostly benevolent, correctly?
I mean, most behavior described as such, yeah.
Yeah. Are you saying that they're a strain of humanity, that they are related to us, like, you know, like Neanderthal or something like that? Or what do you think?
I want to know the answer to that question. That's why I'm still in this, because if it came down to me just having a sighting, I guess I've kind of already had one.
Sure.
But it comes down to how this relates to us. We don't even know who we are yet. And so why am I interested in some other question that I can't answer? Maybe somehow it helps answer that question of who we are. There seems to be a link, because if you go throughout the Renaissance period and you go back into cave art and petroglyphs, you will see the representation of the giant, or you will see the representation of the hairy man, or something that is separated from us. And if you reach back through the New Testament and Old Testament, it will talk about that as well. And these things that are marked and set apart from us, things that they call the watchers, things they call the Nephilim.
Oh, and, do you see the Bigfoot as being one of the watchers?
Well, they certainly watch.
They do.
They certainly watched us. And I think that this is connected to the UFO phenomena. I think it's connected to the death experience. I think it's connected to the spirit world. There's too many examples of people having a psychoactive, out-of-the-body experience while they're having some of these paranormal Bigfoot encounters.
Hmm. Madeline, your rain came back. We can hear it again.
Yeah, it slowed down and then it started up again.
Gosh, it's a good one.
Yeah, we're having crazy rain. Crazy rain.
It's pouring.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what is going on in our world, I mean, today is just, you know, one thing after another. It's just pure craziness. But, the religious part of the world really doesn't know where to put these things, whether it's UAPs or Bigfoot or whatever. You know, the giants, they don't know where to put these things.
Well, that's true. I don't know myself where to put them. I mean, in the book, I try not to go down too many rabbit holes, but there was a rabbit hole that kept coming up, and we couldn't put it to bed. And I was like, how do I write about this? I don't know. You know, it's only 170 some pages here. It needs to be twice that in order for me to mention this rabbit hole. And it has to do with a religious sect of people that came out west. And the group of the religious people were called the Hebrons. Now, Hebron, if you look into it, is an old settlement south of Jerusalem. It's still there, the city of Hebron. Only the Hebron people settled in what is now known as Cottage Grove Lake. Before it was a lake, it was a prairie. And in this prairie, the Hebrons stayed. Now, the Hebrons built their little town about 7 minutes south of the house that I'm researching in the Al Moon Lab. And we keep getting these coincidences of this word coming up, Hebron, Hebron, Hebron. In fact, we order research equipment, including a pair of cameras and microphones. And it was like a camera microphone system. And it came from Hebron. And I was like, well, what are the chances of us ordering something on Amazon and it being made in Hebron? And then all of a sudden, I find out that my girlfriend was gifted a glass from Hebron. Apparently, they're very talented glass makers for stained glass cups and goblets. And so, it's kind of like when you buy a Volkswagen, do you see Volkswagens all the time kind of deal? And I'm aware of that fact. It's kind of pareidolia of the mind, and maybe I have synchronicity on the brain too much. But But I started to look into it with one of the researchers in this documentary, Flash of Beauty. Her name's Sonia Zohar. And Sonia started looking into Hebron for us because she, frankly, had more time to do it. And what she found out is that Hebron is mentioned in a post-flood Genesis time frame. And in the land of Hebron was also the last place that the Nephilim were seen.
Really?
Yeah. And so what if, here we go, I sound like ancient aliens. What if that the people that settled in this community south of us, only 7 minutes, the Hebrons, were also the same type of people that saw giants? You know, because as it was in those times, maybe it was also in the 1800s that these pioneers came to the Umpqua Valley, and this phenomenon is not going anywhere. The Sasquatch are just as apparent as they were in the biblical times. And these Hebron people kind of named themselves, you know, to say, oh gosh, you know, as it was in the days of Hebron, where the Nephilim were seen, here it is again, these men of renown, these giants, these watchers. And so those are the kind of rabbit holes that you kind of have to pick and choose. And that was one of them that, because of some of the issues I'm not mentioning here because they're too lengthy, I decided, I'll just go ahead and chase that rabbit for a little while and talk about the Hebron people. Now, I haven't got any response yet from anybody that's read the book regarding that mystery, but maybe your show, Mark, will be the one.
Uh-huh. So I remember you earlier in the show, you said that the Bigfoot led you to something else in your studies.
Mm. Yeah.
What
well,
is that?
You know,
something
that something else is the conundrum of the extended contactee and how it relates to, you know, this started as a mystery in the trees, and now it seems to be an internal longing. It helps you confront the ego. It helps you look at yourself and why you're looking at these mysteries all together, because when you start looking into these mystery schools, and this initiation process starts to happen, and you start to gain knowledge through gifting and meeting people that are smarter than you, like on these kind of podcasts and talking to other people, you start to confront issues of yourself. And it's kind of like looking into a mirror of sorts. And I never really thought that that would be part of this mystery at all. It's kind of like looking into, a spiritual quest of some kind. But beyond that, there's also the unique aspect of the supernatural, including things that we haven't even talked about, including the dead, including other cryptids, including UFOs, including abductees. I had heard from other researchers about the strange lights, and it didn't take me long to see the lights myself while out Bigfooting, but I didn't know it was connected to people that are also having missing time. I didn't know that at all. I didn't know that there were also really disturbing Bigfoot encounters, including sexual encounters with Sasquatch. I didn't know that this was tied into possibly the elongated skulls or the megalithic structures, including Tum Tum Pyramid out near Longview, Oregon, which is a four-sided pyramid that has been hid from the public for eons. It seems to have a crystalline base structure to it, and it looks like a giant forested Giza pyramid. It's also in a very Sasquatch-laden environment in the Pacific Northwest. So I didn't know a lot of these things, and there's still so much I didn't know. And part of the interviews that are happening, and the reason that Brett, the director, isn't here, is that he's interviewing someone right now that may have answers to some of these questions on what the more puzzling nature of Sasquatch is, including very unique theories on why the Sasquatch yell and howl, very unique theories on how they cloak and how they move and why they move like that, based on more of a Ron Moorhead answer of quantum physics. So there's some interesting stuff that I just didn't know. I'm mainly, when I got into this, was trying to find a cool thing for my son and I to get involved with. And it turned into this other, you know, pretty much all of my friends are Bigfooters now.
Wow.
And, you know, I don't know if it works that way in your own world, but most of your friends are probably into what you're into. And so either my friends are ghost hunters, UFO nuts, or Bigfoot nuts. And in fact, we're on our way out the door in 48 hours to spend 4 days with Bigfoot researchers and do some crazy stuff out in the woods.
I interviewed a lady who was like more of a fundamentalist Christian, but this has been years ago. And she had a Bigfoot experience. She was from Canada, and hers was real negative, and it was ongoing. And she said that this creature just reeked its stank. It was, and she thought it was more demonic, but that just never struck me as being, you know, that's not the nature of what we're seeing.
I think they do stink. You know what I mean?
Yeah, maybe that aspect is true.
But there is also reports of them smelling like cinnamon, smelling like lavender, smelling like basil, smelling like mint. This idea that Sasquatch think, I think, is a tool. Think of it as a bioweapon. If you have something that you don't want near you and your family, and you want it to be invasive, but yet effective and invisible, what better thing to do than to A, maybe release a pheromone, or have something on you like the scent gland of a skunk hidden away that you can squeeze and kind of disperse out to a human. These are the kind of things that I think other researchers need to be looking into.
Do you think of Bigfoot as Homo sapiens sapiens or Homo sapiens something else?
Oh yeah, they're a hybrid of some kind because they have too many puzzling powers. They can get inside your head. They can deliver messages to you in a dream state. They can probably heal through some kind of shamanic healing method. They have too many unique powers of the mystery schools to just be human.
I heard a story about a hunter that had shot one of the female Bigfoots, and I had the impression that it probably healed, or you know,
I haven't heard that story.
Okay, where did I hear that? I can't remember where I heard that, but it was really a shame kind of thing, but the guy was just absolutely terrified, and I don't know why some people. I mean, I can see being scared. I can see being a very have a healthy respect.
Yeah, sure.
But this guy was like overly afraid, I think, because I think it challenged his view of reality.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people do. They want to defend their view of reality, where people like you and I, maybe we like the fact that we get to change our view of reality.
Yeah, absolutely.
After you get through the initial shock, it's quite interesting to be able to gather more information like that.
Yep, absolutely.
Did anybody run across, like, their village, or do you think they stepped out of a different dimension?
Rephrase that again for me, Madeline. I can hear you a little bit.
I said, do you think that, did anybody ever come across like a village or whatever where they live? Or do you think they step out of a different dimension?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So the research shows that it seems as though they have bedding areas, much like a primate do, including these nests. There's a group out here called the Olympic Project. And they've uncovered a nest and had full-on Class A sightings in and around the nest. That's about an hour from where I live. But they seem to also be opportunists that live in places that maybe already exist, including these lava tubes or lava caves out here. There's many of them because it's a highly inactive volcanic area. But if you're asking me my personal opinion, and like I said, part one of Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed, is mostly a narrative story of witness on the flesh and blood experience. And part two, which comes out next year, Paranormal Bigfoot, I'll let it all hang out and talk more freely. But since we're just talking here and now, I think that given what's happened since the mid-2000s, they live in a state of energy form outside of our vision. And they're constantly with us in one degree or another when we're in their habitat. Now, when they come down to somebody's property, generally, I think they're in this cloaked or invisible state, and they're listening and getting information and reading people's intention. That's the other part we haven't really talked about, but your motives and your intention as a researcher or human are automatically picked up on when you come into their vicinity. They're reading your intention before you start your car, perhaps, and they've let us know as much on this property. This smacks of course, of people that talk about abduction experiences as well, where they have close contact with these beings, and they have ultimate control over what happens to them and how it happens. And perhaps they don't even remember their experience till they have hypnotherapy. That's something else we haven't talked about in this documentary. We interview a hypnotherapist, Doug Meacham, who works with Sasquatch witnesses that have repressed memory. And why do we have repressed memories of traumatic experiences? Well, it's to protect ourselves. And so we push these moments, even if they're just incredible moments, still they've shifted us outside of, let's just call it the blue pill world. And now we've been forced to take this red pill, and it upsets everything about the blue pill world. So you put these experiences in these sections of your brain. And we talked to this, I believe he's a Yale psychologist, and he explains why we do that and how we do that and how to access those memories, not only through hypnotherapy, but through going to these kind of conferences where you can freely visit and talk to someone. And these conferences are mainly like AA meetings for people that have memories that they want to share.
So there's a lot of people that are having these Sasquatch experiences.
Well, probably millions, but you'll never know that.
Wow.
And I don't expect anybody to believe that there's millions of people having Sasquatch experiences. All I can tell you is that the amount of UFO experiences that people are having, I think, are equal to the amount of Sasquatch experiences people that are having.
It's a lot
of people. However, the ridicule is twice as bad at talking about Bigfoot. It's twice as bad.
Really? You think so?
Oh, yeah. Especially now that you've got government approval on it, you can talk about ghosts all day. Heck, you can probably talk about lake monsters all day. You can talk about your great aunt Elma coming back to visit you at bedside all day long. But the minute you start talking about Harry and the Hendersons, it's just like, it's game on. And I think part of the reason why is that it's an alpha male phenomena as far as ridicule, because of the good old boy effect. Most of these guys that are woodsmen or hunters don't want to be outplayed and outsmarted by something bigger and badder than them. And if there is a story about, for example, Mark Parker, who's a bow hunter in this documentary, talks about him bow hunting and seeing Bigfoot. Very courageous thing for a man to do, especially a bow hunter. And the ridicule is just twice as bad, yeah.
So there's ego involved.
Well, yeah. Yeah, of course. I mean, and that comes from a place of fear. I have an ego, and anytime it erupts, it comes from a place of damaged or unresolved fear.
Yeah. So Bigfoot, these Bigfoots can teleport, correct?
I don't have any proof of that, but we have plenty of evidence of them moving through a gravel bed without walking. I don't know how anything could do that.
Wow. But they can literally leave our 3D dimension and go into some other reality, right? Into the spirit world, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's reports of them at the Skinwalker Ranch, which, you know, if you're trying to explain to somebody what the Al Moon story is, my book, it is the story of a power spot or a window area. And it's nothing unique or special. I mean, it is, but it isn't, because these places exist all over, including Skinwalker Ranch in Utah and the ranch above it called Blind Frog Ranch. These areas are areas where there is a thinner veil and the paranormal reacts and interacts with the people in and around that community. Someone call it cursed. Let's just face it. Some people would call this land cursed. That's what the Native Americans would probably call it. But if you want to experience this phenomena, you can do it. All you have to do is keep an open mind and a full gas tank and a cell phone signal that works in case you want to, you know, get some help because it's too overwhelming. But hop on Google Earth or grab a globe or one of your maps in the back of your Subaru and go to a remote area of the forest and try to find lakes or waterway areas that have strange sounding names. Things like Spirit Mountain or Spirit Lake or Spirit River, places that are called like Skookum Valley, you know, Hangman's Road, Devil's Creek. All those names that sound kind of ominous, weird, foreboding have a name for a reason. And that's the spot that Henry Franzoni, who's also in this documentary, said go. He said, if you go to those areas, you know, eventually you'll have an incredible experience and it will change you if you let it for the better.
Now, your film is called Flash of Beauty, Bigfoot Revealed. What is your website name, URL?
Yeah, bigfootdoc.com is the website. You can get a load of it there. We always push people to, you know, check out Amazon Prime and type it in. I believe you can access the trailer through Amazon as well. There's also a Kickstarter or a crowdfunding source of one sort or another for part two, because this is, although we do have studio backing right now as far as distribution, this is all a self-funded project. And, you know, if you want to get behind something really cool, you can do that, of course, right now through Flash of Beauty at Kickstarter.com.
If nothing else, we can see the trailer, right?
Go check out the trailer on YouTube. That's right. Or if you want to learn more about the Al Moon Lab, a paranormal experiment. And, you know, it's like I said, it's a pretty interactive book with all the QR codes in it. And check out some of the evidence. You can type in the Al Moon Lab anywhere, including Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or go to Hangar One Publishing and check out all the fine books there.
Al Moon Lab. Is that
Al
what
Moon, like a hoot owl, owl.
Oh, owl. Owl.
Yeah.
Lab. Okay. That's going to be very, very good, I'm sure. It sounds like you are really onto something here. I'm glad you made this movie and you're getting ready to start a second part.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate
a second
you.
Movie? Second movie you're working on?
The second
already?
Movie is coming out. It's actually underway right now. They're filming a sociologist that has some very interesting theories about quantum physics as well. And it's going to be a pretty compelling interview for sure. And that's so. The filming's still ongoing. There's some must-have witnesses that we want to put in here, and we haven't fully locked them in. But, you know, if we wanted to put it all together and edit it and put it out as is, it is a possibility that There's quite a bit. This would be like a 5-hour movie if we didn't edit it together. But as it stands, part one, I think, is 1 hour and 40 minutes. Part two, the paranormal Bigfoot should probably be the same.
Mm. That sounds like a good idea. Don't lose any of that footage. I mean, don't. Isn't it hard to cut it? I mean, do you really want to cut
it? Oh, yeah. Like, I know, Stephen King used to call editing of his book killing his babies. And that is kind of what it's like. You know, you have to just kill off your children, which are these stories.
We just make a part one and a part two and a part three and a part
right.
four.
Yeah. That's what I was going to say.
Yeah, right. I know. Yeah, or bring them back. Yeah, or have a spinoff or something like that. So
sure,
I think there's talk of that, putting some of this cut footage that is on the editing floor right now in a file so people can access it.
That's a good idea, too. Make that the free part on the web we can all
see. Yeah. Absolutely. So, in fact, there is an extended interview available. When people go and type in Flash of Beauty, they'll see the trailer. They'll also see an interview with a gal named Rachel. And Rachel is a controversial witness in the documentary. And I think her full unedited interview was uploaded for the public, and they can judge for themselves.
Judge what?
Well, since it's a controversial witness, there's a controversial photo revealed by Rachel in the documentary.
Oh.
And, when you're working with these witnesses, they're so earnest about what happened to them that you're certain that the evidence that they're bringing forth is a part of, you know, the story, the original story. So for that, we decided, or Brett, the director, decided to put the full video out online for people to judge for themselves on what was going on with Rachel.
So haven't people had, like, extended relationships with these
How do they have them?
No, haven't they had that? Some people have had relationships that have gone on over the years, right?
I think that some people have had better relationships with Bigfoot than the women in their life.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
But
that's
do you?
True.
I mean, I take everybody.
That's amazing, isn't it?
And vice versa. I mean, there's quite a few. I mean, Sally Shepherd Welford was in an abusive relationship and wrote the book The Valley of the Skookum, and her daughter Autumn, out here in Ording, Washington, underneath Mount Rainier, which is also where Kenneth Arnold coined the term flying saucers back in the 40s and 50s. Had an incredible Sasquatch encounter, as well as UFO encounters, because they saw the lights in connection in Ording. And so, yeah, they had prolonged Sasquatch contact. And how do you have a relationship like that? Or how do you have an experience like that? It's just kind of a, you know, it's obviously a Bigfoot lottery of some kind. However, if you start nurturing this behavior or this phenomena and interacting with it and mm-hmm. leaving things out for them, talking about them, becoming friends with other people that are interested in it, it amps up the activity. And to boot, if you start going out into the woods with people that are synced up with you in a unique way. And what I mean by that is that I've noticed that not only going out in the woods and having a carefree good time with someone that has a good sense of humor helps, but also there seems to be a tuning fork phenomena with duos, mainly two people, not two or more, but usually two. And when you find that other person, they could be from any other walk of life, but they are your tuning fork, and they attract the phenomena. And sometimes there's just people that do it by themselves because they're that gifted, and they have, you know, the gift of, talking to forest spirits or land spirits, as I like to call Bigfoot, which we haven't really got into why that is, but I think Sasquatch is a land spirit of some kind or another. They're also just Sasquatch, but I think that that's probably the best way to describe the phenomena. But if you can find somebody to go out in the woods that is your tuning fork, and you did all those other things, including gifting, which if you're leaving gifts out for a land spirit, you can have very interesting things follow you back home. So you may want to do it cautiously, because there is the hitchhiker phenomena where you have things that you're gifting as an invitation to be a part of your home life.
Hmm.
Well, that sounds like something you wouldn't want to really have happen, right? That could almost be demonic, right?
Yeah, it could, because you've opened a portal. You've opened a doorway by trading food is one way to do that. But also objects, including stones and items, like we talked about earlier, these gifts of significance. And that trading back and forth, this gifting process, is almost like leaving an offering for a god. And what do you do for gods? You know, you leave them an offering. And I think these things used to be gods of one sort or another, or at least represented as godlike, because what else is a giant Roman god or a Greek god, right? These are giants of renown that shouldn't exist, although they weren't covered in hair. They had all these other abilities that we've talked about, fast defeat, superhuman strength, can read your mind, could perhaps control animals around them, maybe control resources around you. They were harbingers. So this idea of the giant goes back and is much stranger than just Bigfoot.
So are you saying that
maybe Bigfoot was their pets?
Well,
or maybe we were Bigfoot's pet. Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of wonder with the UFO phenomena whether or not we're farm animals in an ant colony, because
I think we are.
Yeah, and you don't get that same feeling from this phenomena. There's this coldness that exists with ghosts and this coldness that exists with UFOs. You do not get this from Sasquatch. You get you get humanity. You get language. You get gifts. You get brotherhood, especially when you get inside this world of the Sasquatch contactee.
Hmm.
Now, you've had this kind of experience, right?
Yes.
You haven't talked too much about that. Is that something we don't have a lot of time left.
Sure. Well, you know, if people want to know more about it, they certainly can find out through the book. And the main reason I haven't gone over all the details of the strangeness from the Al Moon Lab is because the documentary doesn't get into it. And we're trying to save it for part two. Part one is the flesh and blood world. And it talks about a personal narrative story of the witness. However, just the telepathy element of alone, if you have something that can talk to you and mind speak with you and guess decisions and know things about your life and get in your head like that, you can imagine what that would do to a human full time. And so how do you draw boundaries with something like this? Should you draw boundaries? If you want to have a full-on experience like Roy Neary in Close Encounters of the Third Kind that eventually goes up the Devil's Tower and walks into the mothership, you don't draw any boundaries. You race towards the mothership. And in this case, this is the story of me being Roy Neary, racing towards Sasquatch and basically saying, I'm going to open myself up here all the way to all the experiences, and no matter how crazy, including the UFO, including the ghost, including the religious aspects, including animal mutilations, including apportations, including a possible treatment for COVID. All these things are so unbelievable that how could I put them into one 2-hour podcast?
You mentioned Devil's Mount. Tell us about that. We got only a few minutes. We'll get music.
Oh, I was only referring to Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Devil's Tower is where Roy Neary you know, sees the mothership, which is also a national park, right? Everyone knows Devil's Tower.
Oh, that's interesting.
But yet again, as I said, it's also, it has one of those place names where you can have an experience, right? Why did they choose Devil's Tower for you to have this paranormal experience? And that's what I'm saying. You know, anybody who's listening to this podcast, which from what Michelle's saying is a fair amount, if you want to have your own Sasquatch experience, learn all the native names of Sasquatch or the old names of Bigfoot or the giant. Find them on a map because they still exist, and go stay the night there without any camera equipment and stay there for a week. And so, I would be shocked if you didn't have an encounter of some kind.
So do you think Bigfoot and the giants, you see them as the same?
I do, yeah. I see them as something akin to one another. That's debatable as far as the relationship, but there's definitely a kinship. You know, a lot of people think that the Yeti isn't related to Bigfoot. Well, it is. It's just the Tibetan version of Sasquatch, and so is the Florida skunk ape, and so is the Russian urine, and so is the Titi from Forks, Washington. They're all just different names for a different type of creature. Same creature.
And a different area.
Right.
Is the Yeti, aren't they a little smaller?
You know, they've been described as being relatively close to Sasquatch behavior. I don't have all the trivia on Yeti, but there's a lot of similar attributes to Sasquatch for sure, but less cover. So how is it that the Yeti hasn't been found yet? I mean, they don't have the dense forest like the Pacific Northwest to run away in. So, and plus they have snow all the time. So pretty interesting that they don't find foot tracks and footprints everywhere.
And we never find the bodies, right? Or the bones.
Oh yeah. Well, I've never found anything other than hair, handprints, knee impressions, saliva, and forensic proof via vocalizations that aren't human.
Hmm.
So everything short of a body we found. We always joke that we kind of have Frankenfoot evidence. If we put it all together, maybe we could build our own Bigfoot.
Tobe, great show, man. A lot of fun talking to you. Appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, thanks, man. And thank you very much, Mark.
See you later. Bye-bye. Have a good evening.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
With the institutions, seek illusion. travels to Earth through the rainbow crystal bubbles from the furthest reaches of space and time, across the dimensions, through the elements, and in harmony with the colors of the universe. Through her mastery of abstract stream of consciousness malapropisms, she weaves a web of comic, satiric, cosmic conversation. Her subjects can range from Norman, the goose next door, to astrology and Earth changes, and into the deep recesses of the soul matrix. She holds a wealth of knowledge on herbs, plants, and astrology. Join Mona and her guests on Adventures of a Feral Hippie as she touches the earthly radio waves 5 days a week at 2 p.m. Monday to Friday.